Welcome to the Motoring Podcast, your weekly discussion of motoring news. This is episode 570 on Tuesday, the 19th of March, 2024. Hello, I'm Alan.
Hello, I'm Andrew. And this week we'll be saying goodbye to a Mazda. In new car news, there is an EV with little apparent downside. And in points of interest, we are reminded that safety is very much an afterthought in the US. But first, we have a smidgen of possibly surprising follow-up. And that is the news that Renault and Volvo Trucks, Volvo Group, we were discussing this earlier.
There was some debate over this earlier about, but is this to do with Geely? And it's like, well, not really likely to do with Geely, given it's Volvo Group rather than Volvo Cars.
Yeah.
Just be aware of that, everyone.
We mentioned this joint venture coming together along with the French shipping group CMA middle of last year, I want to say. And it was all about getting together to produce electric vans. It turns out that in the beginning of April, they are going to say how this joint venture is no more. They had, Volvo and Renault had agreed to invest 300 million euros each over the next 3 years. There is no reason being given at this stage as to why it's happened. But obviously, one wonders whether the lack of an IPO for Renault in the Renaultution actually has had an impact, and this whole, it's okay, we've got tons of cash, we didn't really need the IPO, everything's cool, don't worry about it, is having knock-on effects.
Or it could be they've just decided they don't want to do it.
Could be. Hopefully we find out at the beginning of April when they announce it.
Yes.
And if they do, we will bring that as to the follow-up.
But you can't wait, folks.
I mean, hang on, considering what else we cover. How regularly, if they find that dull.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway, do you want to bring us back to the UK?
Yes. The UK, in an act of not quite yet protectionism, the UK government has said that it will apply trade sanctions if the UK's new car market becomes at risk of a flood of cheap electric vehicles.
Could,
yes. Well, no, the article here says will. So the article from AM Online, the wording is...
But if you go to the quote from Mark Harper, the Transport Secretary.
Yes.
He does say that the government could use.
they could. And it's all woods and coulds and all these kind of things. It's absolutely no commitment to do anything. The thing that we were having a very brief chat before the show about this kind of stuff and comparing it to the French attitude. And the French attitude is that, of course, we're doing this because we need to protect people in the French countryside, need better ways to get around, easier access to EVs and low carbon transportation. So here is this grant available against French built vehicles. We all know it is okay. So basically these grants are only available for French cars, and therefore that's definitely not protectionism. Whereas in the UK, then we're really bad for just saying, well, we think we're going to do this and being very explicit about what we're actually doing, rather than disguising it as something else.
Yeah, but also it encourages the calls from the likes of Vauxhall's managing director, James Taylor, doesn't it?
It does a little bit, although he doesn't seem to be calling for that.
Well, he's calling for a cut in VAT, isn't he, on the electric cars?
He's calling for a cut in VAT, which is just kind of dubious as to whether or not that's great. But, you know, even if it gives a headline figure reduction, then actually what he's trying to say is to make the switch as financially obvious for a private driver as it is for a company car driver. And the reduction in VAT isn't really about, it's just about lowering the headline number, I think, to make it more obvious. But then he does point out, you know, making charging costs fairer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 5% VAT on electricity if you charge at home, whereas if you can only do public charging, then it's 20% VAT. And he's pointing out that that's wrong, and I definitely agree with that.
Mm, yeah.
And the last thing he's saying is to make it so that councils and companies trying to install more chargers actually have less red tape, fewer awkward hoops to jump through, so that you can get quicker planning permission, quicker access to the grid, so there can be more chargers and there can be visibly more chargers to make it easy to people. More friendships and stuff.
Yes. Nissan and Honda have announced they've signed a memorandum of understanding on EV partnerships. But it's so woolly and loosely worded that they might possibly work together. No scope has yet been determined on how much of a partnership or what. And they're prepared to do it anywhere across the globe. It's, oh, for goodness
sake.
These
things are literally just an excuse for a press conference, a couple of signatures, and exchanging of fancy pens. And that's it. It's really, well, we might do something together at some point. But we've had an initial chat, and maybe it'll turn into a date later on. But we're just seeing how it goes right now. Finding out what we both want.
Yes, there's a cracking quote from Nissan CEO Makoto Uchida. And it's saying, emerging players are very aggressive and are making inroads at incredible speed, says the Japanese car industry, which has not really moved that far on EVs, considering how far ahead they were 15, 20 years ago.
Even 10 years ago. Nissan was well ahead of others. I mean, partly driven by Carlos Ghosn. But yeah, if Nissan would perhaps stop fighting with itself for a little while,
yes,
it might actually be able to GTF on with it and get more stuff out there. I mean, here you can buy a Leaf or you can buy an Ariya, whatever it is. And gosh, I'm so stirred to my heart by that vehicle. It's got great... Actually, I am stirred because it has really horrible wheels. Just really nasty.
It's massive. It's big.
Sorry, you're saying it's massive, and I'm going, it's not that big, really. But
it's
yeah,
slabs of metal up the side. There's big panels up the side because you've got to hide the batteries.
Yeah. Isn't that the challenge for everyone?
Yeah. Whether anything comes of this, who knows? I think they have to show that they are trying to react to it because the Japanese companies have been effectively caught on the back foot, haven't they?
Yeah, and it's not so much Nissan in this case, by the way. They're the ones with more idea and more vehicles to offer. I mean, Honda over here is launching the Prologue, which is basically a rebadged GM midside SUV. In Europe, it's got the, what's it called? The Anyone?
EY1?
It's any something.
That's got to account for 22% of Honda UK's sales or registrations this year. It has to this year, or they've got the fines, unless they can do the offsetting of carbon.
I'll be doing the
credit.
Offsetting. Or they're selling no cars. I mean, that's the alternative.
Yeah.
Which seems more and more likely every day. There's a reason I don't know. Yeah. I'm biting my tongue on this one.
It's getting ugly. This is something I think we're going to see more of, is more and more partnerships of what were companies competing against each other, particularly in the short to medium term, until the technology is more mature and these companies are on board with it and have enough expertise in-house.
And then, if they haven't died of sales asphyxiation, they will turn and stab each other in the back.
Oh, yeah. And it's going to be great fun because that'll give us loads of things to talk about. Ah, dear. Do you want to take us to Europe, Alan?
Always. But if there's one thing I like, it's trucks. If there's one thing I like more than trucks, it's big trucks.
Now we know why he's moved to America. I'm surprised he hasn't gone to the Australian Outback.
No. The trucks here are terrible. The trucks here are below garden tractors in terms of technology in my eyes. They're just shocking. They're just bad. And so many, the ergonomics, aesthetics, they are. What they're very good at is driving very fast. What they're not so good at, actually, is carrying any loads. They actually have a lower payload weight than European trucks. I mean, standard European trucks are 44 tons.
Sorry, I've taken us way off topic here. Bring us back to Europe.
So bring us back to Europe. European Parliament is backing more what are termed mega trucks. These are articulated combinations, I think is the correct term. An articulated combination which can weigh up to 66 tons. Essentially, so I've got to try and explain this to non-trucky people. Do you know what a wagon and drag is? So you know where you've got a truck and it's got a trailer, but it's not an articulated trailer. It doesn't hinge over the back axle of the tractor unit.
Okay.
It's a truck on its own and then it's got a trailer.
It's like a fixed box van.
It's like a fixed box van and a fixed box trailer with two wheels in the middle. Essentially, what these trucks are is one of those, the front of one of those, and then it runs to a little dolly pair of axles, and then it has an articulated trailer behind it. It's a good few meters longer than an articulated lorry. That's essentially what we're talking about. Obviously, because it's bigger, because it's longer. And here's the important bit, because it has more axles on the road, instead of having 6 axles in these cases, there are 8 axles, all of them braked with ABS, all of them air suspended on the road. Then they're taking that 66.6 tons and they're actually spreading it further across the road. And so they're actually, that means you can carry more goods for less fuel than 2 trucks, and also less impact on the infrastructure with 2 trucks. However, they are very long. And this is where the thing is. These have been experimented with. These run across Scandinavia as it is. So if you are sitting, to take a hypothetical example, in an office beside the port in Helsingborg in Sweden, you can see them come off the ferry from Helsingør in Denmark, or going on, indeed, and then starting to join the Swedish, Norwegian, Finnish road networks. They work there because the roads are big wideness, mostly empty. Let's be fair. And that's where they work best, on big, main, wide roads.
Okay.
And of course, the infrastructure is there for them. You don't need that much. There aren't that many. Moving into the rest of Europe, they are good on a number of levels. Environmental, less impact on infrastructure, all that kind of stuff. Infrastructure does need a little bit modified. You need some longer spaces at service stations.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of stuff. People have tried to run them in the UK. There was one UK haulier who had made a big thing. I don't know how they'd made a big thing about it, but they were going to drive it off the ferry. Literally drive it off the ferry from Europe, drive it through their depot, and then split it. And then it would diverge. So that's one of the things. You end up with 2 trucks out of this. You unhook the articulated trailer, you've got the front part, and then you can drive off and you can deliver with one part. You can hook up a different tractor unit to the back, and then for sort of last 10 miles, last 50-mile type deliveries, then you can do it that way. So running between big logistics hubs is really what they're for. They're not for delivering to end users. That's why the one in the picture from the European Transport Safety Council article that's here is DHL.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because that's the kind of company that uses them.
That makes more sense.
There's lots of stuff in the article. There's lots of things people are saying about, you know, I think they're a good idea. That's where I've come to for those big inter-hub type transport.
For selected purposes and use.
For selected purposes, for minimizing the number of trucks on motorways, that kind of thing. On smaller roads, on single carriageways, then things like the length does become an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Becomes an issue in a couple of ways, one of which is overtaking it. Frankly, you've got an extra however many meters, 9 meters. You've got an extra 9 meters to overtake. It takes a bit longer. You can't necessarily tell the length of a truck just from the back of the trailer.
Not if you're used to 44-ton lorries with, you know, it's basically that back bit with a cab on the front.
Yeah, the 25-meter long job. It's just worth bearing in mind these things. They absolutely shouldn't be used in towns. It shouldn't be. If there's going to be diversions, there's going to be a problem. These are the times when they do become an issue.
They need to be used going from point to point of logistic hubs, just off motorways, that sort of thing. Particularly if they've had enhanced infrastructure around those junctions.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, mostly it's a case of pulling into somewhere and even then and just splitting the truck.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading through this and I thought, well, actually, a lot of this isn't quite such a big deal. Obviously, there's more brakes. So that kind of thing should, you know, and there's more safety stuff. But I see this stuff about fire safety in tunnels if they roll over and block lanes, barriers and bridges across railways. These are not things that they generally have many of. Well, certainly not the bridges over the railways in sort of northern Scandinavia. They certainly have plenty of tunnels. So I'm sure that particular challenge must have been addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And that many of these lessons have already been learned. But stuff like, it says intersections, might use space for vulnerable users during turns, potentially encroaching on pavements or cycle paths. There needs to be some legislation to keep them out of town centres.
Yeah, yeah.
Do be aware there are benefits to these. There's been so much debate in the commercial vehicle press over the years about these. I do feel that this big lorry's big mistake is very much simplifying it and not looking at the benefits and the appropriate controls on some of these kind of things, that the right kind, having the right kind of framework in place about their usage.
Mm. Right, I'm going to move us on to wireless charging, actually, and news that researchers have potentially made a bit of a breakthrough, where they have adapted a Hyundai Kona and they have managed to reach charging rates of 100 kilowatt speeds with near near, as it says on this headline in this Inside EVs article, near perfect efficiency. The efficiency is 96% in the charging test. Comparing it to a wired charger, they're saying that it was something, because they talked about a Tesla Model Y performance on an 81 kilowatt hour battery, consumed 92.2 kilowatt hour when fully charged, and it had losses of about 14% in the charging.
Mm-hmm.
To get it to around 4% efficiency is amazing. Now, again, this, just to reiterate, this is research, this is in a lab, this is not out in the real world yet, but it does appear to be a step closer, because they're talking about as well that this was 8 to 10 times more power dense than other wireless charging coils that are being tested and trialed across the globe, actually. Anyway, do you want to take us to Jaguar?
Yes. Jaguar and Jaguar's I-Pace, many owners are a bit miffed as Jaguar's removed the ability for some third-party apps, in fact, most third-party apps, to act as smart chargers, to integrate with smart chargers, and to deliver the sort of maximum charge for the minimum cost.
Mm.
This is specifically in relation to home charging, really, isn't it? And yep. Some smart energy tariffs.
Yes.
People were trying to charge their EVs to a preset amount, so 80%, whatever, by a particular time, and then they were trying to let the charger and the car debate when was best and when was most economical to do it, and to have that sort of discussion between themselves and the energy company. And Jaguar has removed the ability for that to happen at quite short notice, and not really by quite short. There's a face being pulled. Correct me, Andrew.
Well, I saw this story a week or so ago that there was outrage. We're getting it turned off tomorrow and nobody told us, when Jaguar had got in touch with everybody, or tried to get in touch with all the owners many weeks ago to say, right, this is coming. And added on top, JLR still say that via their In Control app, or In Control remote app,
yes,
you can sort this out a bit. Okay, it's not as seamless or automatic as it would be via the third-party controller, but you can still do this via the Jaguar's own app.
You can do this as a basic outline of stuff. I don't think it does quite as much negotiating with your energy company as the energy company's apps do, or did, but you can still get most of the way there. We've done a little bit of digging behind this, and it turns out that there's a couple of reasons. Obviously, the reason that Jaguar is giving is data security, and that some of these apps might be able to find out an awful lot about you and about your car and all sorts of stuff like that, which you probably don't want them to know.
Added on top, they're apparently not that confident in the security of said.
Exactly, that's the subsequent security, and they don't want something happening that way. I can imagine JLR a little bit paranoid about, you know, vehicle security these days.
Possibly.
I can't imagine why that might be. Not a problem at all, anyway. We've done a little bit of digging and chatting, and there's a couple of other things as well, which obviously aren't headline, but one of them is that it's playing merry hell with Jaguar's infrastructure.
They're not the only ones who have been affected by this.
They are not the only ones who are suffering this at all, by the way. So this is not Jaguar specific, but many of these apps, they ping like mad on servers. They're basically, you know, because they're sort of slightly unregulated, and it's not the app creator's problem, really, at the other end. So they just request information from servers and request information from servers and request information from servers. They are almost causing a DDoS, a denial of service attacks on their servers.
Mm.
Yeah, once you combine all of them together and all the cars, it's becoming very difficult for all the car manufacturers.
Yeah,
it seems to manage that kind of thing, and dealing with that, it costs money.
Yeah,
which ultimately will have to be handed off somewhere else too. And the other little bit as well is that whilst it's doing all this pinging, it's using the vehicle's internal SIM card to do it.
Yes.
The third-party apps are really being kind of cheeky about the way they operate and costing the manufacturers quite a lot of money and infrastructure and all these kind of things. as well as the headline reason of security and stuff, I can see
which
why...
Which we commend, because which, we are ways, the first to jump in when car companies are not being...
And we're very good at giving JLR a kicking. I mean, normally deserved.
They have given us some reasons.
They do give us a lot of reasons to give them a kicking. But this is... I'm not 100% convinced that this is one of those reasons.
No.
There's a lot of stuff in the back end there, which, sure, it's not as great for the consumer... But for the consumer to continue having something to actually operate, then it's probably quite a good thing, really. And it's a good set of standards that these app developers and creators in the future should be working around. API testing, everyone. API testing.
Well, this is another example for me of people rushing to do a thing without thinking it through. I mean, we've had it several times with electric car charging, safe and secure and easy access to all members of society to be able to plug a car in. And then now we're just getting, these are basic rules and design constraints you need to appreciate to when you design your charging things. And we should have thought of that beforehand. This is another one of those examples for me.
But this is tech. And this is tech development. And it's a case of, well, we can do this. And there's a loophole there that lets us do this, and this. Let's get it there. Let's get this out into the market fast, and then we'll develop and work into that later. And that's very much a difference between how tech needs to work and how managing vehicles that will take you down the road at quite incredible speeds needs to work. And there's a difference. And we've been on and on and on about certain EV makers and how that they sort of blur those lines an awful lot. And it's great to be able to roll out an app to a phone very quickly, minimal work. But actually, whenever you don't have to deal with the infrastructure at the far end, then that's that. I once gave a presentation to some quite senior people at the Ministry of Defence, and it was basically part of the theme was an app is for life, an application is for life and not just for Christmas. So it's all very well, we see the little app on our phone, the little square appears. But in actual fact, there's an awful lot behind that.
Yeah, or there should be.
there always is. There's their infrastructure, whether it's your infrastructure or someone else's computers. There's all the connectivity. There's, is there enough bandwidth? Is how do we do this? What are the number of users and all these kind of things? And if you're just putting out the little front end bit and relying on everybody else's stuff at the back end to do things it wasn't designed for, well, kind of the owners of all the stuff at the back end are actually well within their rights to go, oh, hang on a minute here. Who are you? What are you doing? Why are you doing this? No. Mm.
This particular example here is exactly the sort of stuff we have talked about for many years now about be careful, car companies, what you do, who you bring on board, who you partner up with, because the owner is going to blame you, not anyone else's who's affected you along the way.
Not their energy company.
No, and that's unfair, but that is the reality if you are a car company. You have to be super careful who you are prepared to allow anywhere near your car or into your car in any way, because Joe Blogs on the street doesn't care that it's some app down the thing. It's you, as in this instance, Jaguar. It's your fault.
Here's an example. I would quite like my Lexus. Whenever I lock it, I want it to fold the mirrors in, you know, just like my Yaris does. But hey, North American decontenting. Yay. there is a solution for that. There is a solution for that. There is a module that you can get.
You fold them manually?
You can do that if you want. There is a... So old fat... Why would I do that? I have to press a button
get
on
my hands dirty.
I have to press a button on my dashboard. How dare you? So there is a solution for that. It is a little plug-in device, but it plugs into the OBD2 port. And you order it from AliExpress.
Okay.
And then when you lock the car,
see any
it folds the mirrors in. You'll never guess what. I don't want to install that.
Really, Alan? Why not?
But it's an analogous challenge here. Whereas people will not think twice about installing an app, they would probably think twice about installing a completely generic, unknown source, Chinese OBD2 widget physically into the vehicle.
Mm.
It's the same thing, guys. It's the same thing.
I'd like to thank Tom Callow of My Energy, who helped me understand the situation in the marketplace and everything around home chargers and stuff that happens in the background. So appreciate your time there, Tom. That has helped me not think that it was just one person's fault. There are broader issues that you just don't see on the surface. Okay, I'm going to stick with an EV, but I'm going to take us to Fisker. I'd like to take us to Fisker with happy news, but it's not. And when we first threw an article in our Trello running order, it was Fisker prepares for possible insolvency. Well, that's changed. Fisker is still doing that, but they've also paused production for, well, it's saying 6 weeks. It could be longer than that.
Mm.
They announced a few weeks ago, and we did talk about this, that they were struggling financially and they were worried about the making it all the way through 2024. They have managed to secure $150 million from an existing investor, not that anybody knows who that is because they've been kept quiet, which they will get as long as they meet certain criteria over several weeks. However, they are apparently in conversation with a large automaker, as it says in this Autocar article. There will also be an Electrive article linked explaining the first part of the story about how they went, we might go bankrupt. Now, the manufacturer hasn't been named, but Nissan has been rumoured to be that manufacturer. Fisker's in real trouble. They may be pulled out of it, but it doesn't look good for them, I have to say.
It's a bit teetering on the edge. Yeah.
Yeah.
Please don't teeter.
Well, that first part has just drawn to an end.
Yes, that brings us to Guilt Minute, the quick break in the show where we ask for a tad of financial support to keep the lights on and the hosting running. If you feel the Motoring Podcast is worth a small consideration every month, then you can become a patron. Different levels of patron include different levels of commitment from us to you, including being able to watch the show recorded live. We also have a small range of merchandise in our spring store, from stickers to mugs to t-shirts. If you don't have any spare cash, and we do completely understand, then you can help us by following for free from a podcast player to receive every show as they're released, and by liking and rating the show, whatever way your podcast supplier lets you. If you've done all of that, and some of you do, so thanks very much, then the last thing you can do is to recommend us to your friends or colleagues.
Thank you, everybody that does. We very much appreciate your help. Okay, new car news, Alan, and I think we're starting with quite a good one.
There's an epic new model has been shown off by Skoda. It's going to be a rugged urban EV for under 25,000.
Well, the first time I saw this, the name, I just glanced at it and misread it, and I thought it was E-Pig. And I thought, that's unfortunate, but that's what I thought, because it's not a pig at all.
No, it is. It is quite cool. It's like the next model up from a Dacia Spring, really, isn't it? But it's all polished and nice. And sorry, I don't wish to dismiss the Dacia Spring, because it's good too and at a great price point and all these kind of things. But yes, the idea of this is it's a small SUV thing because you've got to have room for the batteries underneath. It's the target price is about 25,000 euros to start with. I would imagine that that's going to be a bit higher by the time it's in the UK. It's a luggage capacity of 490 litres, which is quite big, decent, and a target range of more than 400 kilometres. That's about 250 miles. It's going to be five doors, five seats. It's going to be built on the new MEB entry EV architecture that's being developed by Cupra.
No, but what is Seat doing?
There was a Seat announcement yesterday, and it was like, meh. I didn't even see what the outcome was, but it was an invite to join some live stream.
Maybe we get to know what mobility means to them.
Yes.
Because they were going to be the mobility wing, weren't they?
Mobility. Yes, those always work well.
Sorry, I've derailed this yet again. But so what's it got tech-wise, battery-wise? And
battery-wise. So front-wheel drive, battery options are 38 and 56 kilowatt-hour. The larger one should be able to offer 125 kilowatt-hour charging speeds. And that means a 10 to 80% in 20 minutes, which is a very familiar level, I think, that everybody's aiming for. Battery will support bi-directional charging or V2G. Interesting thing, by the way. When we're talking about European stuff, we always talk about vehicle to grid.
Okay.
Here in North America, they always call it V2H, or vehicle to home, because you're keeping it all for yourself and you're not sharing it with anyone else, because that's how freedom works.
Well, isn't it because your third world grid is going to fall over at any time, so you do need to power your own house?
Yeah, pretty much. Well, no, it's more like there's a cable down, because why bury things when you can just string them up to look ugly absolutely everywhere? Anyway.
We're going to call this the Freedom Episode.
why it was late. Freedom yes. time choices.
It's a chunky little SUV, which, I mean, we're using the term SUV, so therefore half the planet will be up in arms even before they look at a picture of it.
Okay, so it's a chunky little tall hatch.
Yeah, it looks like it's 4x4. What's the wording here they use in this autocad? 4x4 inspired. Meaning there is no chance this is going off-road at all in any way unless there's a bit of grass on a car park.
What's interesting about Skoda is I think from the initial Fabia right through, there is even stuff like the interior design and architecture of the dashboard and stuff. There's kind of a very clear line. There is actually a hierarchy, there is actually a history that you can trace through from the first Fabia right to this. And I think it looks great. This is going to, if it looks anything like pictures, it's going to sell like hotcakes, and it deserves to, especially at that price point.
I think the Renault 5 has got a battle on its hand here because it's very similar price point, very similar ideas behind it. And the design here, this is an electric vehicle, but it clearly is a Skoda if you look at the front end.
This C-minus segment, I think, is going to get quite busy.
Which is good, because the price point is pushed down.
Yes, and they're the cars that sell across Europe.
Mm.
That's the size. That's what they need to be.
Yep, I think this is a cracking one. I think Skoda have knocked it out of the park with this. If the actual model comes out anything like this, and for a very similar price, they'll do really well.
He's readying his cash, folks. He's readying his cash.
It's not far off it, to be fair. 250 miles if the, you know, conditions allowing, etc., etc. But that's still going to be, what, 220?
You should see the gleam in his little eyes, everyone.
I just need to find some money.
He's all excited by it.
Okay, something I am less excited by.
No, from the sublime to the ridiculous, I think.
Yes. Okay, this is the new Porsche Taycan Turbo GT. It is Porsche's most powerful road car ever, according to the headline in Motoring Research. Yeah, so they've updated the Taycan. It is going to be phenomenally quick. And that's before you put it into the, now what is the
Visar
special? Yes, the Visar package, which is a no-cost option.
Mark that one in your calendars, folks, a no-cost option from Porsche.
Yeah, because they remove stuff. They don't charge you to actually remove things from your car. That's nice of them. But it will get from 0 to 62 in 2.3 for the normal GT, or 2.2 for the Visar.
That 0.1 of a second, I can feel it. You can feel it in my bones. Absolutely. That's why I need that extra.
As I career off the road, because I can't control something that could do that speed anyway.
But we all know the real reason for this, don't we? The real reason this exists, not just to show off what they're capable of. Well, there's two things. One is Porsche like to show off what they're capable of with limited edition vehicles, which they then sell for lots and lots of money.
Mm-hmm.
And people will always buy them, which is cool. That's great.
It's why we can get more fun stuff down the food chain that's more attainable for more of us.
Yes, exactly. The other thing is that this is very much a case of, oi, Elon, get in your corner. Just shut up. You've played whatever. We don't care. This is proper and serious. Look, it has brakes and everything. And yeah, it's just making sure that everyone knows that they, when it comes to this kind of stuff, they are at the top of the pecking order.
Yeah.
No upstarts are going to knock them from the top spot. And they have the skills and the people and the resources to be able to just make really crazy, silly stuff and go, yeah, so we can do this and it works. You want to drive it to the office every day?
And it'll be usable every day because it's got a WLTP range of 345 miles. 10 to 80%
that dropped if you're doing too, too many sub 2.5 sec runs to 100 kilometers an hour. I imagine it's a bit shorter than that. But yes.
I think it will be. But it's 18 minutes as long as your environmental conditions allow from 10 to 80% capacity. Prices for those who are attracted to this, it starts at $186,300, and good luck with the option list at that point because it's going to be significantly north of $200,000. I mean, it'll be amazing to drive, I am sure. I am sure that it will be one of those rare EVs that actually feels engaging and entertaining to drive as opposed to just nice to drive.
I've driven the Turbo. The Taycan Turbo S, even though it was just at Millbrook, and it was It was an adequate steer, I suppose. It was great. Yes, very nice.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, much as I say that I'm like, bleh, again, with anything that's ridiculously silly, that's very limited edition, I'm glad somebody's doing it. Mm. Because somebody is pushing some form of engineering to make it happen.
By the way, in the UK, used Taycans are pushing their way, with a slightly higher mileage, are pushing their way down under 35 grand right at the minute. Very good one.
Oh, excellent. I wonder if you can convert those into an old 911.
Moving on, the Maserati Grecale Folgore. I've been practicing that.
It's very good. I'm very impressed.
So am I, actually. Better than I expected. Has got on sale price from £109,905. It is one of six new Maserati EVs due by 2025. Blah, 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 550 brake horsepower, not 62 miles, 4.1 seconds, 105 kilowatt hour battery, 311 miles of range, 20 to 80% in just under half an hour. Yeah, I mean, it's a mid-size SUV.
All the directors who get the Salsac, welcome to another option to have subsidized a new bit of metal on your drive.
Yes. Driver can choose between four driving modes, max range, GT, sport, and off-road. All of them come with air suspension. I would not be off-roading those wheels and tires. Let's be completely clear about that.
No, and the ground clearance isn't exactly huge.
So this is a competitor for the Macan EV and the Audi Q6 e-tron. Just going to be an Audi, I guess. Yeah, I saw a Grecale on the road the other day, one of the petrol ones. It's all right, but I'd rather have an Alfa Tonale. You can get petrol Grecales, by the way, with a mild hybrid four-cylinder or a conventional V6 engine.
To round out new car news, firstly, I need to apologise because this should have been in last week's show, but the UK Car of the Year Awards final car winner, as in the overall bestest car we could pick, has been crowned, and it is the Kia EV9. This is their large SUV, electric SUV, that has come to market this year. It beat their stablemate, the Hyundai Ioniq 6, which is the saloon, and then the Volvo's EX30 was third. So congratulations to Kia for that, and well done everybody who made it through to the final.
Yeah, all sorts of accolades, including Andrew Clues, host of the Motoring Podcast, who added, Kia has stolen the march on the mainstream makers by coming out with a practical large SUV.
I was surprised to see my quote actually appear.
So was I, as I was scrolling through. I was behind one of these on the road the other day. It's a good-looking thing, isn't it? It really stands out. It was the Ocean Blue. Ocean Blue it's called? Yes, because maybe he was looking at the configurator just out of interest because a new story was coming up. Yeah, and it just looked like a concept car driving down the road.
Yeah, whilst it is large for UK roads.
It's about the same size as my car.
Before Alan goes, it's not very large.
It's the same size as mine.
Yeah. It is stunningly well-designed, and inside is lovely as well. A more fulsome review will hopefully happen later in the year.
Good. Designer's Mood Board next. And there was really only one Designer's Mood Board story we could cover this week. And it's the sad news that Marcello Gandini has died at 85. Certainly if you're around about our kind of age, probably a bit older and a bit younger as well, given his massive portfolio of work, then he's behind or had a hand in most of the coolest cars that I think sort of inspired certainly people like me to find cars awesome and cool and interesting. The headliners that everyone mentions are going to be the Lamborghini Countach, Lancia Stratos, Citroen BX, amongst others. And just awesomely cool stuff.
Yeah.
That's very sad to see whenever one of your sort of heroes passes. And but lots of little stuff as well, by the way. The first BMW E12, was it? 5 Series. The first Volkswagen Polos, Renault 5s, Citroen BX, as I've already said, and lots of crazy concepts as well.
Yeah, there's going to be several articles linked in the show notes. There's going to be a wonderful article from Car Design News that is going to be the main tribute that is in there. There'll also be the Wikipedia page for him linked, including a list of the designs that he's come out with, just to give you an idea of the the volume of work as well, let alone how special it is, but just the volume. And finally, we will link to an article on Bonofsky.com about the Volvo Tundra and the story behind that and what's, how that all came about. So, and that is a cracking read with some stunning photographs. And
lightening the mood a little bit, Andrew, a lunchtime read.
Yeah, lunchtime read. And really, if the order had been better sorted by myself, this would have been yours, because this is from The Autopian and it is titled "The First Comprehensive Report on the State of Amber Turn Signals in America is Here." This is to remind anyone or let people know who don't or aren't aware, but you don't actually have to use amber in your taillights to show that it is an indicator. It can be red. And it just, I'm just reminded, like I said in the introduction, that safety happens to be something that can maybe happen at another time with America, because it just seems mad to want red, flashing red, as part of as part of the
It's great because it quite often over, you know, takes over one of the brake lights as well. So it's great because then they, you don't know if a car is indicating, tapping its brakes, whatever at times. And it takes a, certainly for my little started driving in the UK brain, it takes a fraction of a second to work out what the heck is going on with these red flashing lights. And amber indicators have been shown to be safer generally as well. Really interesting article. One of the things that might surprise many of you, some of you, is how many European brands fit alternative all red tail lamps for the North American market, which just seems two fingers. But as somebody pointed out in the comments at the bottom of this Autopian article, it could well be to make it harder for people to buy in the US and then import back to Europe. But I don't really see that that's a cost-effective move in most cases anyway. So I don't know why you'd be doing that.
No, because I think you can just swap that out.
Well, sometimes... Actually, someone was saying in some of them, it's in you can actually do it in software. It's entirely in software.
Oh,
all of the everything.
Oh, yes.
All of the everything is there. It's just been disconnected or reallocated for the North American market. And that's very much the case with stuff like the Land Rover Defender. Whereas for Europe, you get this tiny little orange flashy light. For America, almost the entire cluster flashes, and it's very obvious if it's indicating.
Well, on that front, because I was going to bring this up, that I've got a new bugbear, and that is how small the indicators, brake lights, and the such are on the back of modern cars now. Vauxhall is doing a cracking job of fitting rear LEDs are so tiny that in sunlight, in direct sunlight, you struggle to actually see them. Or if there's someone's got the brake on and they put the indicator, you can't see it because the indicator is inside them.
Yeah.
Yesterday, I was on a country road and we had to stop, and I was behind a brand new Range Rover Sport and we had to reverse. But I couldn't reverse because there was a queue of cars behind me. But the Range Rover Sport just went, oh, I'm going to keep coming back until I tooted the horn. His reversing light was minuscule and down and low in the bumper.
There's a whole Technology Connections video on YouTube all about the uselessness of modern reversing lights, which maybe we should include as a lunchtime watch at some point. There's loads of stuff on this, and don't, because he also goes into the whole American indicator thing. I will try and find the links and share them on social media this week.
Okay. But I just think it's dangerous. The way that the design is going at the minute, it's dangerous. Just because it's an LED, still make it big enough for people to see.
That is one of the reasons for the red tail lights, by the way. There is a minimum size that you're allowed in the US for some of these lights. And so it's easier to do it if you make it all red. Not really a wonderful argument. List of the week this week is from Autocar. And it is Marcello Gandini's Most Brilliant Designs in Pictures, as chosen by Richard Dredge. There are many. There's 51 slides here covering the entire gamut from Renault 5 up to just about everything. Andrew, what's your choice?
Well, it would be very easy to go... See, the problem is we know so many of the designs.
Mm.
And that's not actually a problem.
No.
But I am trying to pick something that isn't one of the classics that are so well known. and I have lumped for the, and I don't feel lumped is the right word.
That sounds really derogatory.
No, I have happily chosen the Mazda Luce, L-U-C-E, which is also known as the 929 or the Cosmo.
Oh, okay.
From 1981.
Hmm.
Because I look at that design and I see so many little touches that are used today.
Rotary engines.
In it. Well, there is that. Although, with this one, where does it say? It says, while the design was pleasant enough, it was the mechanicals that were the most interesting, as this was the only car ever made that was offered with petrol or diesel piston engines, along with the range of rotary units, but not altogether.
Yes.
But I think it looks fabulous, and it very much is an 80s vehicle, but I love all the glass in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the way that he's dealt with the brief, which was to make a four-seater, two-door coupe type car that was almost a saloon. How about you? Because there's 51 here.
50 or so. I've gone down. I suspected you might do something like that. So I've chosen the Sizeta V16T, which is like the Lamborghini Diablo on steroids, of course. Originally bankrolled by Giorgio Moroder, musician. V16 engine, supposedly 520 horsepower output, which was like the equivalent of 1200 horsepower today. 204 miles an hour top speed. 20 were made before, you know, starting a car company is like owning a boat.
Tricky.
Only a boat, but worse.
Yes.
And the company was wound up, but super awesome coolness.
Yeah.
It's four pop-up headlamps.
Absolute poster car.
Oh, totally. Totally.
Yeah. Right, I'm going to take us to the and finally. And this week, we are going to give you Hubnuts video for Rustival 2024. This was the car gathering that Hubnut and several others who are famous, I think is the right thing, famous YouTubers who talk about classic cars and everything. But the idea behind this was everyone is welcome. All can turn up with their cars, but just come down and let's have a chilled, no ego, no tribes, none of this nonsense.
Yeah, doesn't just have to be old, doesn't have to be car. New. Doesn't have to be any brand. Just come along, enjoy it, and enjoy hanging out. Which is great at the start of March when people are just starting to, I mean, it's a brave time of the year to do it, but they seem to get great weather or at least adequately decent weather, which is much as you can hope for in Warwickshire at that time of year. And just the idea was just come along. I mean, they even had a bit where if you didn't really know anyone, you could pop along and people would just generally chat to you if they were a bit, you know, to just sort of say, oh, this is this, so this is, because I always feel that there should be an obligatory thing where when you walk into a car show, you have to put your Twitter or your handle on your t-shirt or something. And just a way of sort of introducing people to other people. This was as much about the human side of it as much about the cars. Mm. I've not seen a bad word about it at all.
No.
And this is the internet. There's normally at least one or two misery guts whinging about something. So it looked fantastic. And a lot of work put in there by Ian, Carly, Steph, and everyone else involved.
Yep. Great. Great effort, great initiative, and I was gutted I couldn't make it.
I had, it's quite significant, it's not FOMO, it's not fear of missing out, but it was, yes, I thought I was missing out because I would definitely have been there were I in the UK.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Anyway, with all of that said, I think that brings us, finally, to the end this week. So don't forget, folks, that between now and next week, you can give us any feedback, share your thoughts for the show at Motoring Podcast. On Twitter and Instagram, on Facebook, and on the contact page of motoringpodcast.com, the hub of all our activities. Remember, you can support us financially via Patreon. Please leave a review and rating on Apple Podcasts or however your podcast app lets you do such a thing. A subscribe on YouTube would be rather lovely. Hitting 500 subscribers would be very nice.
Mm.
But after you've done that, you can then message Andrew. So what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Best way to get in touch with me is either via Twitter or Mastodon if you search for Crack Windscreen, or I am also on LinkedIn and quite active there. Alan, if people would like to get in touch with you personally, what's the best way for them to do that?
I am on Twitter and Blue Sky in both cases. I'm at AJP Bradley. That's BRADLEY. I suppose for professional reasons, I should open LinkedIn occasionally, but please don't. We'll be back very soon. But until then, I've been Alan Bradley.
I've been Andrew Clues.
And safe motoring.